Welcome to the Be Curious podcast, the podcast that champions solutions to some of the world's biggest problems. I'm your host, Louise Houghton, and in each episode, we get curious about a different subject, from the food we eat and the clothes we wear to ocean plastic and overflowing landfills. All of our guests have brilliant minds and innovative ideas to make it easier for you to live a more sustainable, conscious, and pollutant-free life. And the best part is, this podcast is not just about listening. It's about building community and connecting like-minded individuals who are curious about alternatives to enhance their lives and the longevity of the planet. And if you're curious already and want to win some of the sustainable products or services that are offered from the guests on our podcast, then why not head over to our Instagram to find out more about our giveaways. All of the information on how to enter is at becurious_podcast. I am so excited to be bringing the stories in this podcast to you all. It is such a pleasure to share what companies and organizations are doing for future generations. Everyone featured works in a sustainable way, and I love how much people are on the same page, wanting to create and innovate in order to make change. If you feel the same, then why not follow in my footsteps and sign the Science Declaration? This declaration is a call to all nations, societies, and organizations to devote more resources to the advancements of science and technology. They're encouraging people internationally to join forces in battling debilitating diseases, ensuring sufficient food for a growing world population, stopping the destruction of our environment, and engaging in joint endeavors to elucidate the secrets this fascinating universe holds. To add your name, go to make-science-not-war.org and take an active stand to demand more money is put into improving rather than destroying our world. You can also hear more about this declaration at the Future Insight Conference that's being held in Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and latest innovations. The conference focuses on interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary conversations and will cover topics of science, technology, and everything else making huge steps forward in their respective industries. You're also welcome to enter competitions and contribute to their Dream Board, a place that allows you to dream big and share your visions for the future, what you want to see invented, and why. It's really your chance to get involved and take an active role in leaving the planet in a better place than when you were born onto it. That's how I see it anyway, and I hope you share the same view. To check out the competitions, get tickets, or write out your dreams, head to curiousfutureinsight.org for more information. Today we're getting curious about our clothing, something that we put on every morning and never think twice about what it's made of or where it's come from. And here to shed some light on that is Shiloh Euler. Thank you so much for joining us on our Be Curious podcast.
Thank you for being curious about this topic.
Tell us a little bit more about what you do with Commune Closets, because you're the founder of Commune Closets and also a personal stylist.
Commune Closet was born out of the need to have solutions that are sustainable. So One day I was laying in bed, and I personally am a big thrifter, and I was like, how do we actually make this easier for people that don't always do this? Meanwhile, I'm staring at my closet that's overflowing with clothes, and I said, what if we gave people the opportunity to shop in each other's closet? So that's kind of how it was born. So the first I started with actually going into friends' closets and pulling things out and creating videos for people to actually shop in each other's closet. There's precious things that live in everybody's closets. How do we find buyers through that and help make sustainable shopping fun?
And how do you do that? Do you use a platform like Instagram?
So I've started on Instagram. We're working on a bigger platform, but right now it's just through Instagram. So on there you can go, and we've created videos where we've gone into people's closets and helped them shop. And then we're also creating events where I invite all of my friends to basically go in their closet. They rent a rack for a nominal cost, and then we basically throw a party around shopping in each other's closet. So people gather, there's a DJ, maybe some beers. And everybody generally goes home with more clothes than they brought, but they saved money and they look chic and it's better for the environment.
So it's like a fancy yard sale, if you like, but just in a better way. And I think that that's the thing, isn't it? Like sometimes things like that, a yard sale has a bad reputation, and this is offering a new alternative way to actually take something that's secondhand.
Exactly. I would say it's like curated. I call it a community experience to foster sustainable shopping.
Well, there's so many different things that we can talk about when we talk about sustainable shopping. So let's talk about waste first of all. The sheer volume of clothes that we see on landfills is a real problem, isn't it?
Yeah. So the U.S. alone produces 16 million tons of textile waste. Imagine that's the equivalent of 4 million elephants lined up in a row. That's the amount of waste that the U.S. alone produces. There's only something like 470,000 elephants in the world. So if you make that comparison, it's wild.
And that's just clothes.
And that's just clothes. It's about 6% of the trash in the landfill is actually textile waste.
Oh, wow.
Today, yeah.
And if you think about what textiles are actually made of, then a lot of that is not even biodegrading.
It's primarily made of gasoline, which doesn't biodegrade. And it also has a lot of dyes and other fibers that just release chemicals and other toxic things into our environment.
And when we're saying gasoline, what is that? That's kind of plastic, right?
Right. So gasoline, polyester was kind of the first magic fabric that was produced. It didn't wrinkle. It was super durable. You could put it in a suitcase and then you could wear it over and over again. But it's made out of polypropylene, which is actually gasoline. The challenge with that is it doesn't biodegrade. It also, the creation of it produces greenhouse emissions, which causes global warming. And now almost every single thing that we wear has some level of plastic in it. Nylon, spandex, all of the Lycra, all of those are made of plastic, which makes our clothing much more stretchy, comfortable, wearable. But the other side of that is it's killing our planet.
And if you think about it, it's not really breathable either. I mean, a lot of our workout clothes are made of that, aren't they? So they're really tight and flexible when we're moving. But are we actually allowing our skin to breathe when we're sweating?
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you've ever worn a vintage polyester dress, which I have, you have to wear the most extreme deodorant you can because there's no air coming in or out. But yeah.
So if we think about it too, when you say it's actually made of gasoline, I think that kind of rings true in a different way in my mind. You know, that sort of tells me that I'm putting literally the same thing that I would put in my car to fuel that onto my body on a daily basis and allowing it to sit next to my skin.
Yeah.
How would that not be affecting my skin and my body in some way?
Exactly. And the even scarier part is the microplastics that are released when you wash your clothes. So you don't even see them. But as you're like the lint that you pull out of your dryer every day, within that are microplastics that eventually go into the water because as you wash the clothes, they're leaking into the water, going into our food resources and the ocean, etc.
So it becomes a whole other issue other than just, you know, waste. Let's talk more about the microplastics then. Do you think people actually know that their clothes are made of plastic?
No way. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't keep buying it if we did, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole production of current fashion is wild when you start thinking about it. So first and foremost, we take an oil compound and we have to like basically boil it to a high temperature, which releases a lot of carbon dioxide as well as nitrous oxide into the air. Nitrous oxide is 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And both of those are exactly what's causing global warming. So I think most of us don't think about the connection between fashion and global warming, but it's one of the biggest impactors. I think it's second or third in the world, biggest driver of global warming behind like air travel and other more transportation-based.
So if we were to compare, say, polyester to cotton,
yeah.
What are we looking at there in terms of like CO2 emissions used?
The thing about cotton is it does actually require a lot of water to produce. It's about 716 gallons of water to grow cotton that creates one t-shirt. So fashion in general is very, very impactful on the environment. The difference with cotton and other natural fibers like wool, linen, bamboo, is when you put them in the landfill, they'll actually decompose and they become fuel for the rest of the organisms within the landfill. So while cotton is also challenging to produce, there is a life cycle where we can put it back into the ground and regenerate. So the reason for commune closets is consume less. My entire mission is to keep fashion fun, keep shopping fun, but inspire people to shop secondhand because I think that's really the only way that we fix the problem. We're addicted to feeling good and feeling great and buying new things, but there's so much out there.
Yeah.
There's some statistic like for 5 years, the whole entire world could not buy a new thing and we'd still have enough clothing to keep everybody completely garmented.
For that long?
For that long with what's already existing in the world.
So who's to blame for fast fashion?
It's a complicated question. I think first, like capitalism is built on consumption, right? It's mm-hmm. built on growth. It's built on consumption. It's, you know, we earn money so we can buy things, so we can feel good, so we can earn money to buy things to feel good. So I think like the American dream about heavy, about growth, about money, about success is really is about consumption. So I think it starts with that and like basically who we are as a culture. And to be successful is to look good, to feel good, to buy new things. So probably in 2000, about 2000 was the first time I had a experience with fast fashion. I was in Spain at the time and I discovered this store called Zara. Zara was incredible, right? You walked in there and everything was exactly like it looked on the runway. Everything fit well. And I started researching them. And basically what they did is they were the first to create a vertically integrated supply chain. So they would see something on the runway. They would quickly create it and send it directly to their stores. So there was never any clothing in their warehousing. So that was the first way that they started to save money is they basically made only so many units. They put them directly in the store. After 30 days, they would move them out of the store. So they created this sort of like quick from runway to store model, and it really took off. People got really, really excited about it. There's rumors. They're not sure if they're true, but there is some rumors that even say that like the Zara seamstresses were sewing on the boat as the clothes were coming across to the U.S. so that it would be so fast.
That seems fashion, extreme.
Exactly. But fashion used to be on like a 6 to 8 month life cycle. So you'd see a garment, you'd make a pattern, you know, the pattern would go into sampling, the sampling would go into production, and then it would ship to stores. With Zara, they moved from 6 to 8 months to 2 to 4 weeks. So it really changed the game. And it helped consumers see that they could wear current stuff, like basically tomorrow. So that's kind of where it started. That was 2010 when I first discovered it.
And Zara was the first people to really...
I would
really...
say that they're the first. They're the first that were like kind of credited for integrated supply chains, okay. which they basically like took all the efficiencies out of, the inefficiencies out of making clothes. They owned everything from top to bottom, from fabric mills to seamstresses and then directly to stores. So things would move quickly. They also never, ever spent on advertising. They would just put their store next to like the Gucci's and the fancy retailers of the world. So they kind of created this perception of like high-end, high fashion, but it was quick and it was inexpensive. And Zara is one that I still in some ways respect because they do create really interesting clothing and some of it actually lasts. Like I have Zara pieces that have lasted 10, 20 years. That said, they're still using polyester and they're still, you know, producing garments at much more of a rapid pace than is really sustainable for our planet. So yeah, Zara kind of introduced the fast fashion concept to the world and then insert the internet. So now companies like Shein could basically take away the retail component, which actually made them more efficient, and use data, use search analytics. So the founder of Shein is actually a search engine optimizer. So he basically understood how search would work. He would see what people were searching for, early data mining, not early, but you know, probably 10 years ago now. And he would basically say, okay, green jumpsuit. And he would see that that volume of search would go up. He would create a green jumpsuit and put it on the market. They take a small volume of products, so say 100 units, based on what they saw in the data from trending topics on the internet, et cetera, knock it off, put it on the internet, and then they would watch the velocity of that sale. And if it was selling, they'd continue to add product. So they produce almost over 2,000 new items a day, which is wild. One of the challenges, there's a lot of issues.
And where are they being made?
In China.
Yeah.
And one of the other issues about Shein, not only are they using unfair labor practices, because if a garment is $5, there's no way that that worker is being paid an appropriate wage. But they're also, they're knocking off intellectual property. So they'll find somebody on Etsy and they'll see that that matches a trend that they're seeing based on search or based on TikTok or based on Instagram, and they'll knock it off and put it in the market. And because their business is decentralized through China, there's no really way to hold them accountable for intellectual property infringement. So not only are they having poor labor practices with how they're making the clothes, they're also stealing ideas. And then the other one is there's a tax exemption in the U.S. right now. If you ship overseas into the U.S. and it's less than $800 and it goes direct to a consumer, you don't have to pay tariffs or duties in the U.S. So all of Shein's hauls, you know, that's one of the words they use, like my Shein haul, which is 40 items that are each $10 each. None of those are taxed. So they're basically like manufacturing these goods in China, stripping them direct to consumer. And because the quality of the garment is so bad, they won't take them back. So that immediately becomes trash. I get a shirt that like the seam is messed up or whatever because there's no quality control in their manufacturing process because it's so cheap and so fast. All of those garments immediately become trash.
Why do they then not go to a donation site to people in need who need clothes?
I think that they do in some instances, but many donation sites, one, they don't, like if you go to a Buffalo Exchange or any of those kind of slightly more premium secondhand retailers, they won't take that. That low-level product. So that's one issue. Second issue.
What about just like a Goodwill or something?
Yeah, I mean, a Goodwill will take them. The stats say that only 85% of things that are donated actually make it into the sales floor. A lot of it is because there's like mildew issues and things that from the process of me packing at my house, putting in a bag, having it sit in the sun outside of Goodwill before they go to unpack it, the clothing or the garments or whatever gets messed up and they're not going to do the work of cleaning it. Also, those stores are also overrun. So if the clothing is sitting in their store too long, they too either ship it overseas, they incinerate it, or it goes in a landfill. So even if you donate it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to a good place. One other thing that I think is really interesting to note about Shein is that they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
So 46% year-over-year growth from Shein. So we can say like they're doing so many things to exploit people, the environment, avoid taxes, etc. Yet they still have an audience. I think about 6% of Americans shop at Shein. For statistically speaking, they say 17.5 million Americans shop from Shein, which is about 6% of our population right now.
And that's probably just because of the price point.
I think it's because of the price point for sure. And it's also because of our kind of like unsatiated need for new things and to look mm-hmm. cute. And we live in this like Instagram world where we're constantly being fed clothing or like, here's my outfit of the day. Let's do a try on. Let's wear this. So like in the back of our mind, we almost feel like we have to have new things in order to be cool, to feel good, etc. So,
but there are alternatives.
There are alternatives. Before we go there, I just want to put one other thing in the world is yeah. there's a new kid in town and they're called Temu. And Temu is taking all of the practices of Shein and they're even making it worse. They're doing cross category. They're basically forcing their people to work and their vendors to sell to them for cheaper and they're paying them for it. But the scariest thing about them is when you download their app, their app is littered with spyware. So they're literally taking all of the data for your phone and putting it back into their system. So if any of you were encouraged by Temu to download their app for $100 credit, delete it from your phone immediately. They're essentially like, there's two different lawsuits against them right now for the spyware that they're basically taking consumer information. So it's an interesting world. So I think things like this really help people just think before you shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's really cheap or they're forcing you to buy it, maybe you don't need it.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe you did. Yeah.
Maybe you just don't need it.
Yeah. And I think nowadays too, like we were talking about trends and style and things like that, but I feel, and you know, you could probably advise me better as a personal stylist, but people are able to have their own style these days. There's not sort of one style that's in fashion anymore like we've had in decades gone by. I feel yeah. like people are able to do skinny jeans still, but also mom jeans, but also baggy jeans. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, there was just one style of jean that was in fashion. Everybody had to wear it, for example.
Yeah,
What do you feel?
Yeah, I always say that the internet killed fashion
mm-hmm.
only because everything became homogenized, right? There's no, like you said, the fashion industry was actually built on these trends, right? Like you want to get people to be changing their jean style every 2 years because that means they're buying more things.
Yeah.
But now it's moving so fast that we almost are mixing every single trend at the same time, which is interesting, which I actually think it's great. It really encourages people to have their own true fashion and really understand what works for them and what makes them feel good.
And their own identity with it too.
Absolutely. But that's one of the things I hear the most with people that I work with is that they don't know where to shop. They don't know how to shop. They're like overwhelmed with the amount of options because they don't know what's a trend. They don't know what works for them. They don't know what to do. So it almost they freeze and they don't buy anything, or they take the lowest common denominator, which is something that's served to them on a silver platter, like a Shein, or something that's kind of like overly advertised.
Which is made to go out of fashion the next year because it's not going to last till the next year.
Yeah, exactly. It's not even made to go out of fashion. It's not made to last, right? Or it doesn't even fit well the first time, right? You might wear it once because it's new, but then you're not going to wear it again because all day you're tugging on it or whatever because it
and
just
you wash
doesn't.
It and it shrinks.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. But people keep buying. Mm-hmm. There's a whole other school of thought, which is maybe another podcast, but people will say that like fast fashion is important. It's classist to talk about anti-fast fashion. So basically, like, fast fashion allows lower income populations to actually wear clothes and feel good. There is some interesting arguments there, but that said, I think it's still a consumption problem, and we still have the opportunities to shop secondhand from a Goodwill or whatnot. But that's a whole other interesting topic about, like, sort of the socioeconomic impacts of fast, slow, and medium fashion.
If you're like me, then you're curious about the future and what that will look like for our children and our children's children. A great place to feed my curiosity is at the Curious Future Insight Conference that happens every other year. I've already got my tickets to head to Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July for this year's edition. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and their latest innovations. They will talk about the problems we're encountering on a global scale. But this is not a conference that focuses on everything going wrong. Quite the opposite. The Future Insight Conference is a really positive and uplifting place to be because the speakers have been working for years on solutions. From major players like Merck to startups only a few months old, the lineup of keynotes and panels really show the seniority in each industry. And the best part is that everyone is talking about what they're doing to make a difference in the world. This year, among many others, they have the CEO of BioNTech, Ugur Sahin, the founder of Boston Dynamics, Mark Rybert, and also the Nobel Prize winner and professor, Stephen Chu. It's a place where you can connect with like-minded individuals in academia and industry, take part in workshops like the Microplastics Hackathon, and you may even be interested in entering yourself or your company into one of the many competitions they have running annually. They have the Nature Spinoff Prize, Science and Shorts Prize, and the Future Insight Prize is the creme de la creme, awarding €500,000 as a helpful research grant. If you want to find out more about the event and grab your tickets, head over to curiousfutureinsight.org to find out more information. I'll also put a link to the page in the show notes. And if you do come and you see me there, please don't be shy and say hi. It would be such a pleasure to connect with you all.
Let's dive into talking more about the alternatives then, because there are ones out there, and maybe your listeners, you know, are aware of them, maybe they're not aware of all of them, and they're maybe not aware that even there's personal stylists out there to help you find all the different solutions that are more sustainable. So what are our options if we were wanting to be a bit more conscious with our shopping?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, like, look at materials. We talked earlier about polyester, nylons, lycras, these kind of non-biodegradable fabrics. So first stop is, like, try to find things that are natural. So wool, linen, cotton, silk even, because those things we know will go into the landfill. So that's one rule. The second rule is only buy things that you are going to wear at least 30 times. So if you're not going to wear it 30 times, like, put it back. I also use the rule for myself of, like...
What about an occasion dress?
So my opinion on occasion dresses is rental. And I'll talk a little bit about rental in a minute. But I think that I always feel like, will this bring me joy? And will I be able to wear it in a multitude of ways? Like, as somebody who has way too many clothes, I'm always fighting with my closet to find things and pushing things around, and the bar's too full. So I'm like, okay, is this actually going to bring me joy? Do I want to touch this? Do I want to, like, push this around in my closet? Is it that important? I also use the rule of, like, am I going to pack this? So the things you bring on vacation or you take with you are kind of like your favorites. So I only bring new things into my home that will become, like, a packable item, which means that it has a lot of uses, right? It can be worn in a bunch of different ways. It makes me feel good. It's, you know, I want to put it on and kind of, like, you know, feel good amongst somebody I might not have seen in a while. So I think those are some good rules. Wear it 30 times, and does it bring you joy? Occasion wear, there's a lot of really interesting options right now in rental. So I'm sure you've heard of Rent the Runway, Nuuly, which are kind of the existing models. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing peer-to-peer rental marketplaces popping up. So there's a company called Pickle. There's another one called In Rotation, where basically I can put my clothing online and you can rent it for me. And either we can negotiate a price, or there's a preset price for, say, a week. So it allows for a lot more variety in what you can wear. You can find somebody, like, you and I are similar sizes. We could follow each other, for example, and know that we can, you know, fit in each other's things and just rent them on a one-to-one basis. There's actually a store in Santa Monica that's starting to rent clothes. And the Pickle, it's a startup. They just raised $8 million. They have a retail store in New York. So in my opinion, I think if you're going to an occasion, let's rent There's also a company that's called Favorite Sweater, and it's like a trade. Mm-hmm. So it's the same model where I can load my closet and you could load your closet and we can just like barter to make a trade for our clothing for a limited period of time. So there's a lot of really interesting, I think people should think rent for occasion wear first and foremost.
What kind of price point would you be looking at then for something like that, you know, in comparison to buying a new one off Shein?
Yeah. I mean, I think the sad thing is we're never going to be able to compete with Shein.
Okay.
You know, like if I just did a newly rental just to play with it, and for $100, I got 8 garments for a month. So like 100 divided by 8, that's $10 a garment, which is actually comparable to Shein, but you have to be able to spend $100 for the whole month. So that's more reasonable. The rental, the peer-to-peer rentals is very specific to the garment. Where we get in trouble from a cost perspective is shipping. So the Sheins, the Temus, these guys are underwriting the shipping and they're paying for it.
Yeah.
Now, if I try to rent, you know, it's going to cost me $10 to ship it to you and another $10 to ship it back. So even if the rental is $10, you're still at a $30 price point. So that's one thing that I think is a barrier we need to collectively get around. The cool thing is for Pickle in New York and even in LA, they actually have courier services. So imagine like using an Uber to drive a dress from you to me. So again, there is, you know, kind of carbon impacts of that, of a car driving around, but
there's potential solutions.
Yeah,
and actual ways that they can make partnerships to actually take that cost away from the customer.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the same with Poshmark and things like that as well, right? Where you're buying secondhand, people are putting their wardrobes up on there, but again, it's the shipping that you add on top of it, which, you know, can add double the price to an item that you want.
Exactly. And I think that what exists in the world today is it's hard. If you're not somebody who knows what you're looking for, there's not a clean shopping experience for secondhand. Or even, I think, like the newlies, they have a good shopping experience. But the peer-to-peer, you really have to dig. You really have to know what you're looking for. So that's one of the things that I'm actually personally trying to solve, is how do we create like a easy, beautiful shopping and or rental experience for unique, high-quality items to give people an alternative to like dress premium without...
Yeah, because you, Shiloh, you have like a great eye for clothes. I always say whenever I see you that you look 100% stylish. You know, you could be wearing ripped jeans and like a baggy sweater and you look amazing.
Thank you.
But it's just the way you combine these things together. And so I think that when you go into a thrift store, you know, whether it's a Buffalo Exchange or that somebody's donated their clothes and got $2 back for, or like on Poshmark or something, you have to have that eye and you have to be able to sift through. And I think for some, that is like really overwhelming to go into those stores. What kind of solutions do you think that could be found there? Do you think the stores could line up their clothes in a better way that just looks a little bit more accessible to people? Well, how do we get around that?
Yeah.
Get a personal stylist.
Personal stylist for sure. Yeah. And that's one of the problems that my like new upcoming project is going to try to solve.
And there's a giveaway that we'll be talking about later on. So make sure you stay tuned to hear about Shiloh's giveaway.
Yes, exactly. but yeah, that's what I'm on a mission to solve, is how do we make shopping secondhand easy and not scary to those who don't want to dig.
Yeah.
And I think the other part with secondhand is sizing. So I think a lot of people don't know especially ordering online, is it going to fit or is it not going to fit? And if you look at vintage, sizes have changed so much over time. So we're actually using AI to help use measurements to solve for sizing with this new kind of digitized secondhand shopping experience we're working on.
Let's talk about vintage then, because vintage has always been seen as like exclusive and elaborate and chic, and yet that's secondhand. But if we think about a secondhand, just a regular top or a regular sweater that was made 20 years ago, we're not so excited about it. What's the difference?
Yeah. So I think it ties in everything we've talked about, right? A garment that was made in even the 80s was made so much more thoroughly, right? The stitching is better. There's secondary stitching. It's lined, right? There was only so many of them made. They had 6 months to make a garment versus now we have days and weeks to make a garment. So I think the first thing that differentiates is quality. The second is scarcity. We talk about, you know, I have these memories of like walking into a Gap and just like being like, where the hell is all this going to go, right? Just racks and racks and racks of clothing. And that was just the early times when I'm like, kind of, I hate this. I hate the fact that there's all this stuff just sitting here that really has nowhere to go. So vintage, I think, became premium because it was scarce. right? They only produce so many art items. So if you get your hands on one of those, you know that it isn't going to be everywhere else. So I think that's why it's harder to make secondhand as sexy, because people know there's so many items, especially now in the world of like Google image search. It's one of my favorite tools. I go somewhere and I, you know, in a secondhand store, I can take a picture of it and see if that retailer is actually selling it at a reasonable price or not, because Google image search will show every time that that garment is online, and I can price compare and image compare the scarcity value to it. So, So yeah, I think that vintage has gotten a cool name because of those reasons, right? It's scarce and it's high quality and it's unique. I think that we can get there with secondhand, which is one of the reasons for Commune Closet. My insight is that the people that I invite have already curated their clothing. Even if it's not vintage, it's been curated. It's been thoughtfully shopped for. So then when you come to shop in my closet, you're shopping into a curated collection the same way that you would have shopped in a boutique, right? That collection has been curated, though it's all secondhand. And as the seller, I'm so happy to let go of clothing if I know it's going to a good hand versus a donation or a Buffalo Exchange where I'm not getting the value for it, or I just feel like it's becoming trash when it meant so much to me to buy it in the first place.
And you might actually see it again, you know, on your friend or exactly. On Instagram, because they tag you, and that just brings you joy
different way. So much joy. And, you know, sometimes I like dream about clothes that I've given away. Yeah. So if you know where it went, you can be like, hey, can I borrow that back for this occasion or whatever? So it like, you know, the concept of like circular fashion is what I think we should all be thinking of, is like, where did it come from? There's a concept called cradle to grave, which is like taking a product from its inception to its decomposition. If you just think about that when you shop, where is this going to go after? Like, will a secondhand store even take it? Or is it a product like Shein, which is just literally like oil and garbage?
And I think, as you said as well, now that everybody has their own identity and they're having their own style is so much more acceptable than just following a trend, you're able to bring in these items that are vintage. You're able to bring in these items that are 10, 20 years old, and that be okay to wear from a kind of status point of view, you know?
It is interesting, though, as I often think about like a college age demographic, because I think that when we're still like becoming adults, I don't think we have
this
as much
peer pressure.
We don't have as much like confident in who we are as an individual to actually push our own fashion limits. Mm-hmm. I actually was talking to a younger employee of mine, and she said, "You have great style. It feels very 2010. And I was like, "Well, I do wear a lot of vintage clothes." And immediately I Googled, "What is 2010 to see like, what does she see me as? So it came, I agree with you. I always think that vintage is in style, but I think that comes with maturity.
Maybe.
So that's one of the things I would love to try to solve, is how do we bring secondhand to a younger generation? There's actually a very cool app. They've created the TikTok of secondhand shopping. So it's called Teleport. And basically you swipe through it like you would a TikTok. And it's basically me uploading videos of myself, and you can swipe through and yes or no, like a dating app.
Oh.
And then it becomes a shopping experience. So I think things like that will help.
So you put them in a sort of like a short list or something, if you're saying yes to it, and then you can look at them, you say, okay, I want to purchase that one.
Exactly. So I think the founder of that is pretty smart to like use the insight of how we consume social media and turn it into a secondhand shopping experience.
That's a great idea.
So for someone like you, who your clothing matters because you're on film and, you know, people see it every time you take a photo, instantly you could put it up and then people could basically shop. They see you on your podcast and then they could shop that outfit.
Okay. Maybe I'll put this one up. I have to watch it to see what it is, though.
Exactly.
Green jumpsuit.
Exactly.
So how often do you host your events, your Commune Closet events?
So right now my goal is to do it quarterly. The dream would be able to do a franchise of it. So basically set it up and create a model that anybody in any town could basically open their backyard into a Commune Closet event. But right now we're at about a quarterly cadence.
And are other people doing the same thing? Do you have competition, or is this something that seems to be quite exclusive in this area?
You know when you like say you need a new car and you want to buy a yellow car, then all you see is yellow cars?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm having that because I'm so dedicated to this. I'm consuming all of the other alternatives. So the good news about that is that there is a lot, which is really rad. We've talked about a couple, Pickle by Rotation, which are peer-to-peer rentals. We talked about Lucky Sweater, which is a trade. We talked about Teleport, which is the TikTok of secondhand shopping. There's also one that I found that is so incredible. It's called Benny. So Benny, you download as a Chrome extension, or you can download it to your phone. And every time you search for something, it'll show you the secondhand version of that. So if I say green jumpsuit, it'll show me all the places that green jumpsuit has been on Poshmark, eBay, any of their secondhand shops, which is really, it's really cool. It helps people like find solutions easier for the things they want in secondhand. Another thing that's happening in a couple of places is actual brands are creating secondhand versions of their own store. So there's a company called Treat, and basically what they do is they integrate with Shopify and BigCommerce Salesforce stores, and they allow, like, so if I buy the, everything I'm wearing is vintage, but let's say I bought a Gap shirt. I could go on there and I could connect my email, which was the receipts of everything I've bought from Gap, and I can upload it into the Gap secondhand store. Then as a consumer, you can go on Gap and they have a tab that says vintage or however they market it, and it's a marketplace of their own goods. It also enables that brand to take all of their old inventory and make it shoppable. So mm-hmm. they're basically, they understand that they have way too much inventory. Generally speaking, 40 to 60% of any collection that's designed never gets sold.
40 to 60%?
40, 60%. Because wow. it's mostly size variations or the style was dated or whatnot. So
even when they do sales at the end of the season?
Even when they do sales at the end of the season. And it's also wild is if you think of like a Nordstrom Rack or a Marshalls, those guys are not only taking garments that are like, you know, downstream from big box retailers, they're actually have their own manufacturing practices as well. So they too are creating goods to be consumed. So like everybody's creating things because like more equals more money equals keeps your business going.
It sounds like they're being a little bit more conscious now, which is good to see if they're actually starting their own secondhand shopping alongside the mainstream.
Yeah, there's at least three different companies that they're focused on what do brands do with excess inventory. And one of the main concepts is that, like, create an ownable secondhand store so they can see what the life cycle of their brands are. So all of these things I think are really good indicators that things are happening. Also, really big news today, yesterday in New York, the Fashion Act passed in the state of New York, which basically like is the first time the fashion industry will actually have some sort of regulation. Right now, there's no regulation in how things are made, how the fabric is made, the labor practices, et cetera. Everything has to be handled in a one-to-one lawsuit. So the Fashion Act would essentially provide guardrails to hold the fashion industry accountable.
Would that mean that they also have to disclose whether this garment has toxins and things in it?
Yes, they would have to disclose their labor practices all the way through to the toxicity of their product. That said, it passed already in 2021 and it got caught in like labor practices where basically like, how do you actually make it happen? But again, it just passed the Senate yesterday, which is hopeful that, you know, there's some movement in the process. There's also something called Prop 65, which actually was launched in the 80s. To notify us if there was any chemicals in our drinking water and other consumptions, but it does also apply to fashion. So sometimes if you go on Amazon, they'll have a warning that says like Prop 65 that basically says
it may contain lead or something.
Exactly. Exactly. So there is some like, you know, spattering of regulation, but there's no universal body that's regulating the industry.
But I've asked about that lead one before, and somebody has told me, I can't remember my source here, but they actually just said, oh, it's because it was made in a factory that has metal, and so it's a chance that some of that might have come off into the product, and so they have to disclose that, but you're fine. You know, I think as you're saying, it's like we don't have enough information to really know whether this is something we need to pay attention to seriously or not.
1,000,000%. And not even lead, like the amount of the chemicals that go into dyeing of fabrics. Oh, yeah. And like, you know, I think there's Gore-Tex is under scrutiny right now, and it's actually going to be no longer to be able to be produced because of the chemicals that make it so that no water can penetrate it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the awareness. Know. When you start diving into it and you find all of this information out, it can get quite scary. But I think what we're trying to do here with this podcast is say, no, there are positive solutions. We can find different ways to do it better, to use more sustainable materials and to shop in a better way for ourselves, our budgets, and our environment. And although we talk about like what we can do now, I think what's good to also sort of think about is what the bigger companies are doing, because, in essence, we need to kind of challenge it at its source. And those companies are the ones who actually are causing the problem. So they're the ones, in essence, that need to actually make the change.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a whole other category about greenwashing, right? There's so many companies that have used sustainable as a way to sell product. And again, because there's no regulatory body, we don't actually know if their practices are good or not, I think in the show notes, I can send you some companies that are actually like doing a really good job of trying to be sustainable so that people can find brands that are making an effort.
That would be great. Love to list all of those.
Yeah.
And yours as well.
Of course. And one, like I saw yesterday, Mara Hoffman, who's a very famous, she's very cool, like very unique product. She put an announcement on Instagram yesterday that she's closing her business because it was so hard to operate as a sustainable player in the fashion industry. Just from a cost perspective, like she couldn't keep her prices in a way that was obtainable. She'd have to take away her sustainability practices. So we live in a world where it's actually really hard and the customer has to choose with their dollar what they buy. And when Shein is growing 46% year over year, it's really hard for businesses to stay afloat that are doing it sustainably. My whole pitch, as you guys all know, is about secondhand. Mm-hmm. So I think like while we can find brands that are sustainable, let's just shop in the stuff that already exists.
I'll come and shop in your closet any day.
Great. You're welcome. You're totally welcome. There's a company called ThredUp, which is like kind of a mass market secondhand retailer. And they basically say that if every person bought one secondhand garment, it would take 2 billion pounds of emissions out of the air, which is this equivalent to 23 billion gallons of water and 4 billion kilowatt hours of energy. If every person in the U.S. just bought one secondhand item versus a new item every single year.
Just one every year.
Just one.
Well, I think that's pretty easy to do. And that's a really good place to start in terms of like what kind of tips we could offer our listeners to, you know, try and do something a little bit alternative. Just one secondhand item a year. That seems like a very easy, small, achievable goal.
Exactly. Also, if you follow Commune Closets, I'll be making tips for how to shop secondhand easier. You know, sort of section it. There's certain sections to go that you can find mm-hmm. stuff. And then also like the feel of the fabric helps you determine like what's
and
worth.
It's just at Commune Closets on Instagram, right?
Yeah. Commune_closets.
And just before we close up today, I want to hear a little bit more about what you do as a personal stylist, because this is one of the giveaways and you can head over to our Instagram to check out the wonderful offer that Shiloh has got for you today. So how do you go about doing your personal styling?
People usually come to me for two reasons. One, they just want a closet refresh. So they feel like their closet doesn't match who they are anymore, or it just doesn't fit. Yeah. So we go in and we sort of like do a brainstorming session. What feels good to you? What works in your closet? Like who are you today versus what your closet represents? We pull things out that don't necessarily work anymore. I always use the of what to keep and what not. Like, does it fit? Things need to fit well to feel good. Does it like make you feel good when you wear it? Do you feel fantastic? And like, does it bring you joy when you put it on? And is it practical? I think like, is it something you're going to pack like we talked about before? So anything that doesn't meet one of those criteria, we generally pull it out. And then I will shop for you secondhand thrift. I have many, many tricks and tools. And then we can supplement with some classic, just like staple items. You know, I have to say that I always buy new white shirts. That's something that I just don't necessarily buy secondhand because part of my style is so much about like the crispy white shirt that goes with everything. So we have to give ourselves a little bit of flexibility in the rules. Secondarily, it's often events. So for example, I just helped a bride. She had a vision for what she wanted, but she didn't know where to shop. So together we came up with, you know, a mix of we bought all sustainable jewelry, all sustainable purses, all secondhand. And then some of like her wedding dress was custom made for her. So it is about finding the balance and what makes you feel good. So yeah, either come to me for a closet refresh and or help styling around a particular event.
So people could just give you a budget and then say, okay, I've got $200. What can you find me in a thrift store?
Exactly. Exactly. And hopefully like it could either be like update my closet or it could be I'm going to a summer wedding. Often I get tapped for like theme parties and those things as well because I have a ridiculous collection of odd clothing that kind of fits the cowboy parties or the disco parties or whatever. The
costume in some
way. Yeah, yeah. And I found that costume becomes clothing. They're not quite, mm-hmm. they're very interchangeable in this day and age, particularly in California.
And knowing that, you know, it's come from a sustainable source helps you feel good too. So
exactly. And I think also that's why renting is really interesting, right? It's like anti-committal, right? You go on a few dates before you know you're going to marry somebody. Why don't we treat our clothes the same way, right? Like, let's try it. Let's see how it feels. If we like it and we don't want to part with it, we'll keep it. Otherwise, send it back.
So many facts and figures that are really shocking, and I really appreciate you sharing them with us and our listeners today. And as Shiloh said, she does do personal styling, and she does also have a giveaway that we have, our monthly giveaway. So head over to our Instagram at becurious_podcast, and you can go to @commune_closets as well to find out more information on all of her things. And if you've liked what you've heard today, then please subscribe, like, share as well. And we will be back next week with more from the Be Curious podcast. Until then, make sure you stay curious. Thanks so much, Shiloh.
Thank you, Louise.